For nature.
For the ocean.
For people.
For animals.
Okay, we are online now. Nice. Welcome, Science Planet community. I really want to share with you something amazing today. I have such an honor to interview Damian Mander. Damian, welcome. Thank you that you're here, that you take your time to talk to us and to share your important message with us and with this community. Thank you so much for your time.
Maggie, thank you so much, mate. And that means a lot coming from you. I've done a lot of research into your background and everything that you've given up, and not just an individual, but the organizations you've worked with, in particular Sea Shepherd, an organization that's very close to my heart and the work that they do. So thank you for everything that you've done, and to your viewers and program for having me on today.
Wow, thank you. Well, that's a crazy honor too. Thank you so much. Cool that you checked out a little bit what I do. I did not expect that. Thank you. Well, Damian, there is an amazing TED Talk from you online. I saw that TED Talk and I have to say I had to cry. And I, if I'm allowed to, I will put the link to this TED Talk in the show notes so people can really watch it, because it's such an incredible story. But first of all, you have been an Australian sniper. I mean, you have been a sniper, which means you know how to blow up things in the air. You know how big shit is done, right? But now you're sitting here in front of this computer as the vegan activist who founded an organization like one of the big, huge anti-poaching organizations in Africa. How did this happen? Can you tell us a little bit of your story? How did this change happen? This is crazy, crazy beautiful.
Yeah, it wasn't like I sat there and mapped it all out and said, this is what, what we're going to do. A lot of it was progressive. And I'll say this, it's that doing good, I think, inspires us as individuals to want to do some more good. And I wouldn't say I necessarily started out as a great person, probably selfish in a lot of ways, but starting to do things for others, and in particular animals and the people that protect them, inspired me to also not only query who I was and where I came from, but how can I be something constructive in what I would term post-military, the next phase of my life. Early on as a kid, I grew up as a sort of, I wouldn't say a kid with a troubled background, but definitely, I just had a lot of anger within me. And I was always, whether it's on the football field fighting or, at school fighting, and then I sort of had this persona that I was trying to live up to. Then moving into hunting and just hunting, to try and not to try and put food on the table, but to try and get some sort of primal respect from other people. And it was about me. It was a selfish action. And to try and build up my own image, took aim at the vulnerable, went on to the military, served as a Navy clearance diver, doing underwater demolitions and tactical operations. After September 11, I went to a newly formed special operations unit called Tactical Assault Group East. Served as a special operations sniper there. 2005, deployed to Iraq for the better part of 3 years, and then finished there in the beginning of 2008, trying to figure out the what next in life. We sort of went downhill very quickly. And I suppose there'll be a lot of people in the activist community that can relate to the trauma and the post-traumatic stress of dealing with, some of the things that we have to see. And it's definitely no different for a lot of people that have worked in the military. And then not only leaving this tight network of people around me that were part of my team and were watching my life and were my best friends, my brothers, but having this purpose for whatever reason that purpose was. And then all of a sudden, all of that stops. And I found salvation or comfort in drugs and alcohol. Mm. It seemed like a soothing thing at the time, but it was actually a fairly hard and rapid downward spiral over the course of a year. And then, being strong enough as a person to be able to realize when things are not right and change needs to happen. It's one thing being able to realize change, and I think that, that's the most important step, but then also the implementation. And so being able to say, hey, just because you've done well financially, just because you've served in some elite military units, just because you've survived a bunch of years in Iraq, it doesn't mean that life is over and you know your purpose is finished. It's time to what next? And I found the what next traveling through Southern Africa, started working with some wildlife rangers, seeing the lack of resources they had in comparison to what I had as a soldier. But also seeing what was happening to animals, in particular wildlife, and elephants and rhinos, and seeing that I had the two things that really could have been a difference for some of these animals was money, and some, you know, skills that I'd got and experience I'd got from the military, and came out and looked at solutions and implemented pretty much all that I knew, and that was a fairly militarized solution to animals that were being targeted by very aggressive tactics, and in particular elephant and rhino. Set up the International Anti-Poaching Foundation in 2009 with a mission of to protect and preserve wildlife in volatile regions. I was the first and only employee at the time, having arrived in Africa with nothing but a carry-on bag on the airplane and a one-way ticket. And, you know, after 9 years, we've scaled to have a portfolio of nature reserves that we own in conjunction with local communities, to have 8 reserves, 240 staff, protecting 1.3 million acres of land under our management, home to billions of sentient creatures of all different shapes and sizes, as well as the trees that they live amongst, but also to be running a program out of Kenya called Lead Ranger, where we've trained more than 50 instructors from existing and well-established conservation organizations, both public and private. And those rangers or those instructors oversee a portfolio of over 1,100 rangers that protect 14 million acres of African wilderness every day. So that's the snapshot of where we're at and where we came from over the last 12 years. But there's obviously a lot more detail in between now and what happened back in establishment in October 2009.
So this is incredible. Like, your whole story is so touching as well. And I believe that, you know, biggest change comes always from emotion, by sharing emotion. That's how I experience it a lot when I give speeches about the things I have seen and witnessed. And you are such a huge and strong man. And when you talk about the animals and your reason to protect them, every time I could cry, every time. And because it's so touching. And thank you for being so much more than a man with a gun, you know? There is so much more what I can feel when I listen to your words. And thank you so much for sharing this real honesty. It's amazing. And as a founder of the IAPF, I can imagine that you surely had or faced quite a lot of wind blowing against you. I think it was not always easy, and you had probably a lot of struggles going there. Is there a special moment or what was the hardest thing you faced in this time when you founded it, or even to now?
Now, I would say the biggest enemy we've faced has been in the actual industry itself, and it's just not very fostering for new people that are trying to come in and set things up. I mean, to be fair also, you know, we were perceived to be some like charlatan organization, getting a lot of media attention and competing with other organizations for funding and public attention and projects. And so we didn't really collect a lot of mentors earlier on. We didn't get the contracts that we wanted. We were ousted in a lot of respects. And in a way, that became our best friend. Those challenges pushed us into a corner where we were forced to do something that hadn't been done before, create new models in areas that nobody else was doing any work. And we've just flourished since then, actually. So, you know, like the toughest challenges have become our best opportunities, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. You know, to give you another example, I invested my life savings. I bought my first house before I was 21 in Australia. Mm-hmm. Australia is a very well-paid military. And then I made quite a reasonable amount of money working as a private contractor in Iraq. All of this money was going back into a real estate portfolio back in Australia. And then when I set up the IAPF in 2009, I liquidated 100% of what I had. And regardless of if you're a billionaire or you're only worth $100,000 on paper, whatever it may be, what I had at the time, I put 100% into setting up the IAPF in 2009. We started scaling the organization as a service provider, working with other organizations and helping them with their security, their wildlife security, which is a very small component of what we do now. But and then in 2012, there was an article that ran in some papers in Australia about former special operations spies from Australia working in some African countries. Zimbabwe was named as one of those countries. And everything that I had basically was lost overnight. Zimbabwe carries a death sentence for espionage. I was exiled from the country for 2.5 years after having invested my life savings, having built my own house, having built up a project portfolio. Now, I suppose at this stage, and we had a couple of $1,000s left in the bank. At this stage, this is probably when most people would have packed up and gone home. I moved to South Africa. We set up our organization in South Africa. We found a huge project across the border from South Africa in Mozambique. To fund that project, we went to the United States and registered in the biggest philanthropic market in the world. And so being exiled from Zimbabwe and losing absolutely everything turned us from being a Zimbabwe-focused organization into a globally focused organization. And it's taken us to where we are today. You know, we have one of the largest conservation land portfolios back in Zimbabwe, a country I couldn't re-enter for nearly 3 years. But we're also, you know, expanding these programs across the continent now because of the fundraising we've been able to do in the United States, which was a direct result of being exiled from this country in the first place. So, yeah, a lot of people will look at challenges and say, you know, this is it or the end of the road. And for me, it's just, I know that when I get through the tough times, we're much more resilient as an organization, as well as me as an individual. And the pressure that is applied to you, regardless of how and where that pressure is coming from, it can produce some of the best results.
Yeah. Well said. I mean, I know this in a very much smaller scale than you have faced it, but I see it as well when I do projects and campaigns, and I see it as well, the things which are the biggest challenges in the end, I can only learn and grow from that personal and use it as a knowledge to change things, to implement things, to create a bigger impact and to reach more people. And if we as activists see this possibility to use this big crazy shit sometimes in front of our house as a fertilizer, then I really think that we can create something amazing. So I always try to see the shit as a fertilizer. it's easier said than done. Yeah. I mean, it's really easier said, right? Shit can be fertilizer, but you have to do it as well and to take the shit in your hands and smell it and to really put it out on the field. That's the hard work.
I love it. And there's also something very constructive to be said about just not giving a fuck what other people say, think, or do around you. Just having your own mission and going on, and you know, collecting good partners along the way, working with good people. But the people that want to sit there in the background or on the side and throw stones, that's what they do with their lives. They throw stones. I'm too busy out there getting my hands dirty to give an absolute fuck what anyone else is saying in that respect.
Yeah, totally. Hey, when I saw the TED Talk, it seemed as well the biggest change, why you do what you do right now, started with a story with a rhino, right? When you saw a rhino as well, which got poached.
There's a couple of catalyst moments. So, you know, being, you know, a buffalo with its back leg caught in a wire snare, ripping its pelvis apart and having to be euthanized and giving birth to a stillborn calf in that euthanasia, you know, while it was being euthanized. And then, of course, seeing an elephant with its face cut off is a very confronting, not only thought, but you know, it's something that consumes every one of your senses when you see it up close. The smell, the sight, the sound. I mean, the yeah, everything about it. You know, not to say that an elephant's life is more important than any other animal, or an elephant has a different capacity to feel pain, but just to see something so big and symbolic killed for something you can hold in one hand, I think for me at that time, I was ready to see that as a transformational moment in my life. Iraq had given me a different lens through which to see the world. And I suppose that, you know, maybe a chink in my armor of, you know, this macho person, this sort of alpha male who previously probably wouldn't have blinked twice at a dead elephant, probably could have even been the one pulling the trigger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Why do you think that, what is the main reason for poaching to happen? I mean, there are different animals getting poached for probably different reasons. What is the biggest reason? Probably, I can imagine, has a lot to do with money, right? I mean, it's always a money topic much behind, but are there different other reasons too? And if it's money, where does the money go to? What is done with this money mainly?
So there's two types of poaching. There's subsistence poaching, which is done from someone that's trying to survive or put food on the table. And I can talk about that later from a social development side and the work that we're doing in communities to try and reduce the need for people to poach from a subsistence standpoint. The other side is commercial. We have people at varying levels that are involved with feeding these resources and this money into organized crime syndicates that are involved with wildlife trafficking, human trafficking, guns, drugs, and counterfeit operations, and wildlife parts such as an elephant's tusk or a rhino's horn are just other currencies for them to feed into that market. And it's very much similar to the drugs trade, in that you have different layers, and we are targeting multiple layers within these syndicates. The difference between what we are fighting in terms of the wildlife trade versus the drugs trade is, in the wildlife trade, the damage is done at the very beginning, when an animal is killed, whereas in the drugs trade, the damage comes when the user is receiving and using the goods at the very end of the chain. So for us, you know, being able to build systems that, one, try and reduce the need for people to poach or the want for people to poach, as well as also being able to take out the ability for people to go out there and do this as a way of making money to feed into organized crime.
Yeah, because I have been in some places trying to save wildlife, ocean wildlife mainly, as well from poaching and protecting the animals. And a lot I can see as well, I mean, I don't have the numbers and I cannot see it's for everyone the same, definitely not, but a lot it is really due as well to people who are very poor and don't see another chance of making any money. So another question would be, what is the need of change we can all create in this world to change this crazy? I mean, this is a crazy big question and it's not easy to answer in a short sentence. Yeah. What can people as well do at home, like me now sitting here in Italy? What is there something we can do and participate to make the big change we need, that this whole thing starts from another area to be changed too? Not just the people who really try to make the money, but what is behind? How?
Crazy. Poaching is one issue that we face. It's part of a much bigger issue, which is biodiversity loss, which is again part of the big issue, which is the climate crisis. And so we shouldn't do is be overwhelmed by the situation. We are facing monumental challenges as a civilization and as a species, but from a conservation standpoint, there's never been a more exciting time to be alive. The world is on fire. It's burning. It's cooking. It's flooding. Great. We have an amazing challenge in front of us, and you know, let's get to work. We have to change the way that we operate as individuals. With this consumerist mindset that we have, we need to understand the important things in life are not things, they're actions and relationships and how we lead our lives. The world that we want to leave for the next generation, for most of us, for many of us, that'll include our children. And also look at, you know, where we can't directly be involved with work on the ground, Other than changing our, you know, habits within our own lifestyle, but how do we support good organizations that are out there? And shifting a lot of the focus from us as a species, where we put so much into, say, religion, healthcare, education, and start to have a bit more of a balance where we put some funding, some more funding into biodiversity conservation. We're sitting here now with, you know, millions of people across the world that have died from COVID-19. Billions that are in lockdown, and we're talking about trillions of dollars in international deficit. And if we just invested some of this in protecting the natural world in the first place, we wouldn't be having this conversation. We already have the best regulating system on this planet for climate, and it's called nature, and it's been refining itself over billions of years. So for us as an organization, it's very easy to try and be distracted by the so many things out there that need to be dealt with. But the important thing is to pick something and be good at it and go and work at that. Not only working on ourselves and how we evolve and how we make better decisions personally, but how we are part of a movement or a change, whether that's for animals, for the environment, or for the social aspects that implicate how the environment is looked after. For example, the work we do in Africa is very much from a social side, working with local indigenous communities to create alternative livelihoods, to work with healthcare, education, water, sanitation, infrastructure such as roads, to help achieve a conservation outcome. So instead of looking from inside the reserve out to the community and saying, this is our area, we're going to protect it, we're working from the community in, saying, all right, how do we get this community to a point where they see the value in not only nature, but in conservation as an action?
Yeah, I think that's a really, really great answer and a big point, because many times people, like, for example, me as a white European, I could go everywhere and say, hey, this is wrong, you shouldn't do this and do that. But conservation doesn't work like that. I mean, that's what many people see strange. It's important to work together with the community at the place. So it's changing from there. It's so important. Thank you so much. So you make a lot of programs as well, not only about, how does a typical day look like for you? At night, I can imagine you go a lot out in the bushes to check out and poachers. What is the rest of the work? I mean, there is, like you said just now, right now, there is so much behind it as well, building community projects together and changing their lot. What is the typical day for you?
Well, you know, my role varies now, and it's very much working closely with an amazing management team that helps see our portfolio across Africa and our work in regards to outreach and fundraising around the world. Currently, we have around 270 people that are part of the organization. And that's, we expect that to double in the next sort of 24 to 36 months with the support that we're getting and the traction that we've gained in regards to the model on the ground, in particular Akashinga. A day in my life can vary from anything from doing a podcast to having a meeting with our management team, to speaking to donors, to I've just spent 2 months in the United States. So, there's a lot of travel there that's involved. I also work for National Geographic as part of the National Geographic Speakers Bureau. So traveling around and speaking to audiences of up to 2,500 people at a time about conservation and also about our journey as an organization. So, and then, of course, the field work, going out, sitting with traditional leaders and local government and federal government, negotiating land deals where we will partner with communities from anything from sort of 20 years to 45 years to help them achieve some of their social goals and allowing us to achieve our environmental ones at the same time. So it's a fairly dynamic diary, I'll say that. And I know it frustrates the hell out of everyone from my mother to our chief operating officer, because nobody can really guess where I'm going to be or what I'm going to do, myself included. And you probably know, having tried to corner me for the last couple of months for this podcast, it can be a little erratic. Fortunately, I have some very scientific and analytically focused minds as part of our management team that help keep me in check.
Well, that's important to have the people who can help you. I can imagine, I can feel you have so many projects in your mind. You want to do so many things and even make it bigger impact every day. So But you can't be everywhere. It just doesn't work. Like I do many projects. I write books. I make a movie. I make the foundation now. I give speeches. I do workshops with kids and many different things. At some point, you cannot focus on the one thing you need to do right now in this moment because it's too many things. So it's good that you have people, good people who help you with that as well. Always again to shift you back where it's maybe right now as well needed. And yeah, but it's a different thing to be the founder of the organization who is in the action and to do the marketing for it, right? It's just a different kind of work. It's a different job as well. And
You know, you start off and in the beginning, you're doing everything from negotiations on projects to fundraising to writing legal documents to designing posters for fundraisers to building websites, writing mission statements, hiring, firing, doing the training, implementation, research on the ground. And you're wearing all these hats, and it's only over time that you sort of have the, I suppose, one, the knowledge, and two, the financial flexibility or freedom to start building out a team. But also, you know, refining what it is and how you do it on the ground as well takes time. I feel, you know, we are 12 years old as an organization, and really it took us better part of, you know, more than 7 years to really refine what it is we do. Mm-hmm. And what we do, nobody else does. And so, you know, they're unique programs, and they were refined not only to meet the requirements that we identified on the ground, but also to match the skill sets that we'd built out as a team and as an organization, and the vision that we developed. And again, trying to align that vision with something much bigger than what we can deliver as an organization. And that is, you know, there's this global picture that we're talking about and meeting the emission reductions of the Paris Climate Agreement. Mm.
Yeah. Well, you were mentioning before as well, Akashinga. I'm not sure if all of the listeners here know what Akashinga means or what it is. Can you explain a little bit about this project? Because it's something really interesting where I have a question for you about women. You are teaching, training women to fight back and to protect animals. Why women? Why especially women? And why? Because I feel that for me, for example, I feel that women have, is it because of their instinct to protect their family? Like it's a, why women? Why this project? And what happened?
You know, again, it was one of these things that didn't start off with a huge map or a pathway forward. It was something that we just started. And the commencement of the program was based on a number of sort of, I would say, brick walls that we'd hit, a number of things that were frustrating us at how we were operating. We were becoming increasingly militarized as this conservation organization, doing, you know, achieving great conservation outcomes in terms of protecting species, but doing it at the cost of a relationship with growing human populations living alongside the areas we were trying to protect. So the bottom line is it wasn't sustainable, and we were trying to find a different model, a different way of doing things. We saw other industries getting ahead by getting more women on the board, more women as CEOs, more women in management. And then overlaid their progress with the conservation industry, which women, you know, are heavily outnumbered, particularly in an operational sense, by men, and given limited opportunities to be able to gain the experience they need to manage either programs or organizations. So we wanted to try something different. We didn't exactly know what it was going to look like or how it was going to start. We're still a little apprehensive. We saw other models that had given some inclusion to women, but definitely more forms of what I would call tokenism. Women were given certain roles, but not full roles, but portrayed as doing every role for the sake of fundraising. And then, you know, we're working not only in a, very patriarchal industry, but a patriarchal society in Africa. And then I was reading an article in the New York Times in 2017 about the U.S. Army Rangers putting women through army training and preparation for frontline deployment. And so that was the catalyst for us to say, well, okay, if the U.S. military is doing this, then there's no reason why conservation can't trial this. And that's when we went out and we started scoping the potential of setting up an all-female armed anti-poaching unit that was tasked to protect an entire nature reserve. It would go on to become the first nature reserve in the world to be protected by women. But it was a difficult conversation to have initially with local government and also with traditional leaders. Again, very patriarchal in terms of the culture that we were dealing with. And also us as an organization, we were trying to shift away, at least in a trial basis, from where we had come from. I'd come from the ultimate boys club of special operations. The women can't be a part of special operations. So I'd only worked with men. I'd built a career across three continents in training men for frontline deployment. Again, it didn't involve women at any stage. So I was going through my own internal challenges for change, as well as organizational, as well as industry, as well as cultural. So we really were swimming upstream in regards to getting this program off the ground, and we battled. And it took, seven different areas we tried scoping with local communities and with existing conservation stakeholders, and they all said no, we didn't want to take the risk. And we found an abandoned trophy hunting reserve in Zimbabwe, mm-hmm. that essentially had nothing left to lose but the trees. And we were able to scope an initial agreement there, which grew into what you see today, this program that's scaled to, from 16 women initially protecting 90,000 acres to 1.3 million acres and 240 staff and on track to having 1,000 staff by 2026. And with just so many positive spin-offs and benefits that have come from the program, and us as an organization is centralizing our strategy around women's empowerment, giving them the opportunity to create their own futures, that becoming the best traction in community development and conservation, becoming a byproduct of these initial actions.
Yes, wow. So many great benefits. It's really amazing. I mean, I think when you, like you said, you come from a group where there are just like a special operations, just men allowed to start to open yourself as well for changing this whole program into as well taking women to do this job, what normally is seen just as a job for men in the typical people's minds. I think it needs a lot of courage for you too. Like, you need to open yourself so much. And I'm really incredibly thankful that you did that. And that's really amazing. I can imagine it was giving yourself as well a lot of benefits as a person to open yourself for a different version of doing the things, how you have been doing them before. Like, really.
Yeah, it's definitely, I would say, very confronting in the beginning, knowing that you'd come from a background of reinforcing a culture that had oppressed women, whether intentional or not, being part of this boys club and being sort of proud and macho about it. And then not really giving any time towards women being involved with conservation. And then I remember sitting down in the first 2 days of our pre-selection interview processes with the first 87 women that were trying out for this program. And so the selection criteria, aside from having a designated age and health bracket, but they were all survivors of serious sexual assault, domestic violence, AIDS orphans, single mothers, and abandoned wives. And sitting through those first 2 days of interviews was probably some of the toughest moments I've been through. What I was going through is nothing in comparison to what these women had been through, but it was very confronting. And I will say, again, maybe from almost a selfish standpoint, it feels very rewarding to be able to see what these women have done in regards to the opportunity that they grabbed. And, you know, there was no concessions given to any of these women. They all fought for the position that they got and the lives that they've built for themselves. The first question we ask these women when they come in, what are your dreams? What do you want to do? Akashinga is not about giving them a uniform and a weapon and telling them to go out and defend an area. Mm-hmm. It's about giving them a platform or a stepping stone to do whatever they want in regards to education, rebuilding their lives. In a country that when I first arrived in 2009 had the lowest life expectancy in the world for a woman, 36 years of age. And while that has improved into, I think it's around 55 or 56 at the moment, it's still a tough place for a woman to exist in rural Zimbabwe or rural Africa for that matter. And to see now the majority of our women within 18 months of joining the program have bought their own land and built their own house. For many, that means getting their families back together. Women that have gone back and got their high school diplomas, women that have got their driver's license, which may sound just so basic for so many people, but for a woman in rural Africa is a huge achievement to be able to have that opportunity because they're just depressed from getting such things. Mm-hmm. Women at university, one of our women, Niradzo Hoto, recently gave a lecture to Harvard Law School in relation to animal ethics and wildlife conservation work. So to see the development and what these women are doing in their own communities, mm-hmm. and the benefits that means for everyone in the community, the expenditure going into a circular economy, other people benefiting from the construction these women are doing, more kids getting into school, higher attendance rates, their parents, their siblings, people getting better healthcare because of the money and the support that's going in. All this is a result of us shifting our strategy on conservation. Mm-hmm. And I can say 4 years into this program now, bearing in mind we're in our 12th year as an organization, I can say after two decades of law enforcement, conservation and military work, that putting women into the forefront of conservation, of law enforcement will shift the dynamics of society for the better. Mm-hmm. Women, we haven't had a single incident of corruption with the women in a country that ranks as having some of the most serious corruption rates in the world. Women naturally de-escalate tension in potentially confronting situations. De-escalation means demilitarization. That means we don't have the military-grade hardware that we used to have. We don't have the helicopters, the aircraft, the canine attack teams, and the military-grade optics. We cut our core operating costs by two-thirds through demilitarization. The initial third, which is invested largely into women, is the most effective form of community development funding, and there's an overwhelming body of evidence that tells us that. The other two-thirds that we saved is reinvested back into healthcare, where we go in and fund clinics to get medicines and registered nurses and basic solar electricity and lighting in places where women are delivering babies by candlelight before we're able to offer any support with no drugs or support. Education, we've got 120 primary and secondary age school children going through scholarship programs at the moment, as well as being able to fit out and help rebuild sections or entire schools in the area, as well as the education for the staff that are part of our program. We've got infrastructure helping to grade roads so people can get access to market with products that they're selling in these rural areas. Water sanitation, helping to drill boreholes in strategic places to provide that clean drinking water to communities. Building things like town halls that the community requests and part of their own strategic plan. So that's what we're able to do with the money that we save, instead of spending it on helicopters and drones and canine attack units. We're spending it on these social issues and tackling these social problems. And it seems the more every dollar we spend on dealing with this from a social side is $1 or $2 less we have to spend on a law enforcement side.
Wow. It seems like this all is so much bigger than in the first moment we see when we hear the anti-poaching organization. We see, okay, anti-poaching people going out and trying to catch the poachers, but this all is so much bigger and creates such a big impact on all kind of fields and levels around it. It's amazing. Wow. And I think, like you said before, it might be a bit selfish. I mean, you called it a little bit, it might be selfish for yourself to be happy and to be proud of what you have done, what you are doing here and what opportunities you can help to bring. But I think this selfishness is definitely a good selfishness. And this one is very much allowed to be there. Mm-hmm. To feel good and proud of the things you are doing there, because this is just amazing. So I would have 1,000 questions, but we are with the time going a little bit late, but maybe another time we can make another podcast. But I have another question for you as well, which is very important. How can people support the IAPF? What is the biggest need you need, the biggest need you have right now?
Yeah, I mean, for us, going back to what I said before about how do we make changes in our own lives and how does that fit into a bigger picture? So that would be my number one request. And of course, I think the biggest change we can all make in our own lives is the decisions we make at our dinner table. You know, the food systems that we have, the implications that bad choices have on our planet, on our personal health, but most importantly on animals, the individuals that we choose to be a part of killing. And the suffering that they lead during their lives.
You turned yourself to a vegan activist. I mean, you were eating before, and now you're vegan. Why? What? Why? What?
I walked around the bush for 3 years protecting one group of animals and managed to convince myself that I was doing enough work and had enough good credits to deserve to keep eating other animals. You know, we're masters of creating excuses to suit our conveniences. Chickens aren't going extinct. Cows aren't going extinct. These animals were bred for our consumption. I'm already doing enough good work in protecting nature. The reality was it was all bullshit. And eventually the bullshit was too much for me and I didn't want to be a hypocrite. As a conservationist, you get involved with this line of work generally because you love the environment or you have a respect for animals or a combination of the two. And here we have the meat industry is responsible for the greatest degradation of the natural world. And then also responsible for the death of 100 billion animals a year around the world. And so we as one species on this planet determines what level of suffering is acceptable for all else. And as an alpha male, I will say I not only didn't want to be a part of a system that exploited the vulnerable, and animals sit right up the top of the vulnerable list in society, but I didn't want to pay someone else to do something that I really wasn't prepared to do myself anymore.
This is amazing. It's just amazing. And yeah, there's so much information herein, and I hope that all of the people who listen to this podcast now, Sanus Planet Community, please take this time and listen to it, but not just listen with your ears, but with your heart and feel these words, because there is so much more behind everything we buy, every product we buy every single day. We can make a change. And that's one of my sentences always, like, with the knowledge I had yesterday, I have done the best I could have done yesterday. In this moment. But if I know it better today, I can do it better today. I can make a change every single day. And that's what we can choose every second in our lives. And that's what you are one of these big examples for. You did change your life from this side of the road, completely far away, to that side of the road. And it's like, wow, it's just wow. But I one more question. What is your biggest message right now? What do you want to share right now, the most important thing right now for you to share with this community?
Yeah, I think one of the most powerful forces we have as individuals is our activism. And but also one of the greatest deterrents we can have is the feeling that our comments and our ideas are falling on deaf or silent ears. And you know, my comment to that was keep having your conversations and keep getting better at them and never stop and never give up, because a conversation we have now may feel as though it's falling on deaf ears, but the truth is accumulative. It adds up, and whether it takes a day, a week, or a decade, eventually we start to break down to the truth. And just, you know, don't be disheartened with what may seem like a one-way message, because it's not. You know, that would be my message to there's so many people that are out there that are fighting for this cause, whether it's the environment, whether it's animals, animal rights, conservation, wildlife conservation. It's all intertwined, and this is not a hobby or phase or a career. This is a lifelong endeavor. It's a passion, and it's something that needs to be done.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Damon, for your time. This was just an incredible interview. Thank you so much for your heart and for your work and for all of the guys which are working with you. And so every single one of you, thank you. Can you please pass this on to your team? Because this is all of you together. It's always a together, right? And change always starts with someone, but it is in the end a whole community which is needed to bring the big change we really need on this world. And please tell this to your community from deep in my heart. A big thank you from our side, and I will try to see that the whole community understands how much important this cause is and how much we can support this. And stay on track, awesome, keep on doing what you're doing. And I say now bye to the community, to the Sunless Planet community, and maybe one day Damon has another time when he could share another half an hour maybe with us with some other questions about the elephants and the rhinos. And I have many more questions prepared. Another time we can go into that, maybe, Damien, if you have time. Thank you so, 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 so much.
Thanks, Maggie. Thank you very much. Thanks to all the listeners. And good luck. Thank you for your hard work.
Thank you so much, Damien.